Welcome back to another episode of Conversations with Nova Reid. I cannot believe we are storming through season two so quickly. I've really enjoyed being able to share some of these conversations with these human beings and incredible experts, healers, activists, humans. It's a real pleasure to invite you into their worlds and also into mine a little bit more. So how are you doing? As ever, a huge shout out to my Patreons. I love our little intimate community and love receiving your support so that we can see this season through. It is much appreciated. Before I get into introducing you to this next guest I have, I want to just read something that I received from a student. Given the work that I do, I often see a lot of trauma and violence on black bodies. So it often means that there's this imbalance. There's this, I am seeing a lot of trauma and heaviness and hate. So what I like to do to counteract that heaviness and hate is ask for words of encouragement. I call them love notes, love letters, or just people to express their gratitude. And I think my next guest and I talk about this in this episode, how it's really difficult sometimes to understand and gather any kind of measure of the true impact that your work is having on an individual level. Because the work is very, my work in anti-racism is very much self-directed. People that are doing my online course, that work is theirs to do. Like, no, I cannot teach anybody how to unlearn your racism. That work is yours and only yours and only will ever be yours. And so it's sometimes difficult. You don't get that feedback unless it's offered to you. And so I invite it. I ask people to share how this work is helping them. I ask people to send words of encouragement or words of gratitude as a way to pay it forward. I love receiving them. It's really resourcing and nourishing for me. So if you're listening to this and you're not sure how you can help in some way, paying it forward for people who are on the front line of anti-racism is one way of doing that. And there are many ways you can pay it forward. One of that obvious is by volunteering time or monetarily. But it can also be in letting the people who are on the front line and dealing with sometimes really difficult circumstances know how much their work is impacting you. So sometimes I get poems, sometimes I just get emails, sometimes I get videos, and there's a poem that one of my anti-racism students shared. She's on my course, and I just want to read it to you. Dear Nova, I cannot wait for your book, even if it means to throw it against the wall and pick it up again. I want to be pulled inside out, because that's what your short course has given me a glimpse of. And now, as I'm embarking on your full version, I can't imagine how much of my inner and outer worlds are going to change the world. I'm expecting a tsunami. You have a way with words that makes us feel we can do this, that we can face ourselves and be accountable and not be ashamed, that the world does care, that just some people have forgotten how to go about it and are fearful, as I was, although still but less, as I know better now. It's truly hard to describe the impact you have had on me, Nova. You open hearts, you open minds, you present people with another world where we can actually be better and do better. Thank you, Nova, author, activist, gentle ass whipping teacher, great descendants of amazing ancestors, for everything you do. Sorry for the cost you have to bear and endure to enlighten us all. You are loved. Some people look up to Beyonce or Schwarzenegger. Me, it's you. You can send me all the love notes and poems and letters you like, because they really do resource me. So you know who wrote this. I appreciate you. Thank you so much. Over to today's episode. It is another one. I say this with most because they all are, because I curate my podcast with intention and care, with people who I am close to, connected to, inspire me, and all of the above. And today I'm joined by healer, trauma expert, and author Resma Menakem, author of My Grandmother's Hands. Now, Resma is also a New York Times best-selling author, LA Times best-selling author, New Washington Post best-selling author, and a trauma specialist. And he has always been doing this work, but of course it's taken on another level since racial justice has been given a global spotlight. But he's been a guest on Oprah Winfrey's show, I think Dr. Phil as well, and is doing really important embodied work to healing racial trauma. And I've had the pleasure of meeting Resma, I think, I can't remember, probably November in 2021, and working with him. You can also find Resma and I in conversation talking about everything from gaslighting to Meghan and Harry and Britain's firm role with denying racism and trauma over on his Instagram. And at some point it will be over on my channels as well. But we have a really rich conversation. We just decided to get together impromptu. We're having a catch up and in March impromptu. And Resma says, do you mind if we record it and just vibe? And I'm like, yeah, no problem. And so, like, I feel there's an element of kindred spirits, because there's so much of what he teaches that is in deep alignment with what I teach. And some of what he does is put words to things that I didn't understand. And you know, there's been my own personal journey, which I am still on, to healing from racial trauma, that informs part of the work that he does. And it's just a rich conversation. And we talk about everything from white body supremacy, reclaiming humanity, blackness, and what that really means, and the essence of who we are and where we all came from as human beings, right through to trauma and why white people find it so hard to do this work, and why there's often lots of desires to do anti-racism work in this embodied way, and or just anti-racism work in general to be one of the good ones. And when they realize, or I should say, when you realize what is at stake and what it is that you need to uncover and be with and confront, a lot of people start shrinking into the wings. So Resma and I go all the way in. I, as ever, would love to hear what you think. I lurk over on Instagram, and so does Resma. I'm on Nova Read Official, and I will link to some of the lovely resources that we reference in this episode so that you can enjoy them. And let us know what you think. Over to the episode. So welcome back to another episode of Conversations with Nova Read. I am joined by the delectable Resma Menakem, author of My Grandmother's Hands, and I will also call him a healer. Resma, thank you so much for joining me.
It's good for me to be with you today.
Appreciate your time. I love to kick off these episodes by asking my guests who you are beyond your roles.
I'm a son of a beautiful Black woman. Mm. I'm a husband to a beautiful Black wife. I'm a father to two beautiful Black children. I believe that my people and our people in the diaspora are beautiful representations of creation. I believe that something has happened and continues to happen to our people. And I believe that it is our job to make sure those things that happen don't reflect us being defective. And that at every turn, I believe it is our job in general, and my job specifically, to help our people and bodies of culture understand that we are not defective. I believe it is my energetic duty to help our people and help our peoples rise using a foundation, using a foundation of blackness, a foundation of potential, a foundation of creation itself, in order for us to remove the shackles of white body supremacy. That's who I am. That's what my work is. And yeah, that's it.
Wow, that's an answer. Okay, let me ask you, let me change this up a bit. When did you first realize you were black?
Searching my brain and trying to, you know, a lot of times when I've seen other people ask other people that question, there are these stories, these very dramatic stories. I think the first time I remember, like when I was coming up, the neighborhood that I lived in was primarily black and Puerto Rican in Milwaukee. And there were very many of the white people. I think the neighborhood that we moved in, the white people were just starting white flight. So a lot of my early experiences up until sixth grade was being like, I had a black female teacher. I had a number of black female teachers coming up. No black male teachers until I got to high school. But I think that there was a point where the school that I was in at sixth grade, I was getting ready to go to junior high, and the neighborhood that I was in did not, and I had a kind of a leaning towards art and music, and there was no junior high in that area that had that kind of magnet. And so the neighborhood that was all the way across town in South Milwaukee, all the way across town, and I had to be bused there. And that neighborhood hadn't had a whole lot of, very few black people there. It was all white, German and Polish and stuff like that. And then here this busload of black and Puerto Rican people, kids were coming there. Well, I remember, going to that school, and just seeing how, like, you pull up to the school and everything was new and clean and all. I mean, it was just that piece. And then, but I think what made me understand that there was something different was coming home to my mom and not knowing, I didn't really realize what she was doing until I was much older. And she came home, when I came home that first day, I remember her saying, how was school? And I said, it was cool. It was fine. She goes, so what happened? Not what you learned, not what it is. She goes, what happened? And I said, well, you know, we got there and I went to the orchestra room because that's what I was, that was the instrument that I was playing was bass. And she goes, how was folks? Right. And I think that's the first time I remember having her check in on me about where I was, how I was being perceived, or how people were, what people were doing to me, in a racial sense.
Yes.
And she did that for all three of us. Me and my two brothers, she would check in on, you know, what folks doing, right? How they, not just how they treating you, but what you picking up on. right? Mm. And that was that's, I think those were the first inklings of something. There's something about me and my skin, or me as a person, that needs to be checked in on.
Yeah.
So that's, yeah.
Thank you. You're welcome.
And can you share more about the story that led you to, well, naming your book, My Grandmother's Hands? Can you share more about that? It was so beautiful the first time I heard it.
So my grandmother, my grandmother was a very, she's just a very beautiful woman. She had a good heart. I really think that the world, pieces of the world broke her heart.
Yeah.
But she was always resonant with us, right? She was always like, come here, you know, and my grandmother loved, my grandmother loved to fart. She would, I remember us being like, grandma, and she'd just be laughing. She'd walk away and stuff like that. I mean, she just loved fart.
I was not expecting that.
But my grandmother had this really like belly laugh when she would laugh, and she would shake her. She would shake. Right? But my grandmother would, so she would lay on the couch and we would be on the couch with her, and she would put her legs across our thighs and then she would watch TV. And I remember one point, and this is another one of those things that I didn't remember till I got much older. I would be rubbing her hands, and I would be comparing her hands to my hands. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother had these thick hands, these thick pads inside, and these thick pads on the top of her hands, and then these thick digits, right? My grandfather had the same ones. So I was rubbing her hands, and I said, Grandma, you know, without even really thinking about it, Grandma, why are your hands so fat? And without missing a beat, she didn't even look at me. She was so interested. Oh boy, that's from picking cotton. Like that. Mm. And I'm sitting there rubbing her hands. I'm like, wow. Like, you know, picking cotton. And then she turned, she must have caught the vibe. She turned, she looked at me, she said, I said, no. She goes, cotton plant got these burrs. They got these burrs, these things that stick out. And, you know, we started sharecropping when I was 4 years old. My daddy was a sharecropper. So we had to walk up and down in rows, right? And she said, and you stick your hands in and that stuff scratch your hands up. And until you get them calluses, right, your hands gonna bleed. And then that's the way she was talking, like with a activation in her body. And then she stopped and she looked and she kept watching TV. And I didn't remember that story again until I was much, much older. Actually, when I started writing the book, right? Yep. And I was like, ah, man, because I was putting all of these things together about trauma. Hmm. And that story like landed. It was like, boom. Right. And then I was talking to my mom. This is after I wrote the book. I was talking to my mom, and she you know, my mom was reading the book, and she said, you wrote that part in the book. It made me think of like when you wrote the, you know, yeah, my grandfather had those hands because he sharecropped too, with his parents. But my mom says, I noticed you didn't write about her feet. And I said, they made her pick cotton with her feet? I mean, like, what do you mean with her feet? And she said, well, they didn't have shoes. So when they would walk up and down them rows, them birds would break off and cut their feet up. Mm. Did you ever notice she had that thick pad around them? I said, yeah. She goes, yeah, that's from getting her feet cut up. And that really sent, like, that was one of the culminating things in terms of, like, my own trauma, that being folded in, or my grandmother's trauma folded in, or my people's trauma. All of that came together. And that's how the book came about, was just these pieces that never get recognized around how we hold this stuff in our bodies. And it makes us think that we are, something's wrong with us, yeah. Right? Because a lot of times we don't know how to talk about this. We don't know how to say something about this. And so we say, well, it just must be me. And without understanding that, you know, the brutality that's happened to our people didn't just happen to us individually, it happened communally.
Mm.
And that part of our healing is to reclaim those things that they tried to tear asunder. Reclaim those things, those intelligence, those ties to creation itself, right? The thing for me about Black people and Blackness is that it is both a skin and a pigment piece, but it is also a value, and it is an intrinsic value, and it is a value, a philosophical value that I say that everything comes from Blackness first. Blackness is potential. It is tied to creation itself. What they call the Big Bang is really an emergence, right? And creation deemed that the first human representation on this earth would be a Black woman.
Yeah.
That's philosophically mooring for me, right? To know that every human being on this earth came through that Blackness.
Mm.
And part of our work is to right order these pieces so the Black woman can continue to provide, so that the Black woman can continue to be free to create and tie into creation. If that doesn't happen, this thing, this world, this idea of a human family will cease to exist.
Yeah.
It's a threat to all our humanity.
A threat to all our humanity.
Do you know, I'm going to share the story of how I came to find you, Resma, and it links to this, so bear with me, I'm going around. a friend and colleague and sister, Tamu Thomas, shout out, she used to be a social worker, so she has a similar backstory to you, and she now does somatic body work and healing work. And it was summer last year, you know, the resurgence of Black Lives Matter and, you know, sequence of violence on Black bodies that was just impacting all of us. And then George Floyd. And on average, Resma, I get about 800 hits to my website a month. Overnight, I was getting 40,000. And I could not, understandably, I could not cope with that insatiable appetite over me. I had my own trauma triggered, and I was trying to figure out how to deal with all of this stuff. And Tamu says, get Resma's book, My Grandmother's Hands. I'm like, babes, I haven't got the capacity to read or absorb anything. Like, nothing is going to go. And she kept saying, Resma, mannequin, Resma. I was like, I don't know. I don't have time for this. And so I'm firefighting, and I'm trying, and like, as you say, I'm trying to use all of my self-care, all of the methods that usually work, and nothing was scratching the surface in terms of just looking after myself. And I can't remember how this came about. She must have purchased something on my behalf, and there was a playback. And she said, I've brought you this. It's a playback. Make sure you watch it by whatever date, because there was an expiry date. And do that in a few months' time. And so I think I got to this was something you did around all August, and I got to it eventually in October. So bearing in mind, she'd been on me since June. And I finally got to this workshop you were hosting just for Black women. And I watched it in October, and I was writing at the time as well. And I had a terrible, I was having a bad day and I couldn't write. So I thought, right, let me watch Resmaa Menakem. Let me watch. And I knew that creation claim from a Black African woman. I knew it, Resmaa, but I didn't hear it until I heard you say it. And that was the most, I was cathartically sobbing. All the grief I had been carrying just was coming out. And there was more to it than that. Obviously, Resmaa, you know the work that you do, but, and that's how I found you. And it was like your words were reverberating through every fibre of my being in a way that I hadn't been seen or heard before. So, yeah.
You know, it warms me to hear you say that.
It's the truth.
You know, sometimes doing this work, you don't get a sense of the impact that you're having on people. You're hoping you have some impact, but you don't get a sense of what actually is helpful to people until you are out here doing it long enough. And one of the things that I think has been, that I'm starting to understand, there's little nuggets that I think really do help Black folks. And I think the idea of what I call the right ordering, reminding us that that on this earth, we are descended from the first. We are literally descended from the first human being to touch this earth. And reminding us, I'm starting to notice that our people need to hear that. We have been so terrorized and brutalized that simple things like that, more often than not, don't come in, but don't get in. But there are times where people are in a space to where it does come in. And when it does, it germinates. Mm-hmm. And when it does, it moves, it roils, it pumps, it's juicy. It's all of those pieces. And what I hope so it's that piece, and then telling Black people that they're not defective.
Mm.
Those two things I have seen, just people, the activation, the healing activation starts when people hear those things. So thank you for saying that. It is nurturing to me to know that some of the things that I'm saying are helping our people have some reprieve from this madness, mm-hmm. and helping them get rooted back into creation. That's helpful for me.
My pleasure. So it leads me to ask, how did you move from social work into healing racial trauma, I guess?
Yeah. I actually I think I've always done this work. I've always been doing it. I didn't have a rubric for it. I didn't have, you know, somatic abolitionism. I didn't have a term for it, but most of my social work stuff has always been around racial stuff.
Mm.
Even when I was coming in my undergrad, it was around racial stuff. And in my graduate school, it was around. It's always been about that. I think my mom said I came on a planet leaning into people. She said, the other kids would move away from people. She said, you worried me because you would lean into everybody. You know what I mean? That worried me, but I've always done this type of work. Now, my, I think the more growth I've had and the more maturity I've had, I've been able to articulate what I've done better. Like, you know, now I can say somatic abolitionism as a rubric for how to begin to abolish white body supremacy. But I think I've always done that anyway. The healing pieces, once again, I think I've always done that too in some type of way. I've always been looking for what herb does that, or anxiety and all this different type of stuff, vitamins and that. But I think I came on the planet as a healer. I think that's the way I came, and it took me time to grow into that in terms of, and I'm still growing into it. But yeah, my name, I got a name from my elders about 30 years ago. And so my name, Resma Menachem, means he who causes to rise in the alignment of truth using the foundation of his people. And it's ancient Kemetic. It's a Kemetic, ancient Egypt, which is not white, but I need to say that because most people think. But about 30 years ago, I got that name, and in the Kemetic, kind of philosophy, your name unwinds, and it unwinds and it guides you. So the way you are at 21 in terms of how your name and the symbols of your name should be guiding you, that changes when you're 28 or 35 or 42, right? And so it is an emergent, your name is an emergent piece. And so I really, you know, when I received my name, after about 9 months when I got it, it just landed. It like washed over me. I was like, yeah. That's it. That's pretty much it.
Wow. That's incredible. Thank you for sharing that. So for listeners that are new to language that we're using quite fluently here, why do you call white supremacy white body supremacy?
Yeah. Because if you notice, when we talk about white supremacy, it gives people too much room to genuflect to intellect and cognition, right? Mm-hmm. White supremacy, and people, even white folks, white folks, white bodies have no collective agility or efficacy when it comes to race. None. Don't. If there's somebody on here, if there's some black intellectual right now that's listening to us and pulls down the podcast and they go, well, in 1937, you know, really the white book. Stop gaslighting yourself. Stop gaslighting other people, right?
Yeah.
The fact is that when it comes to a living embodied anti-racist culture and practice, collective culture and practice, white folks have not had to understand the nuances of race, have not had to understand the vibrations of race, have not had, their livelihood and lives have not depended on them understanding it, right? Mm-hmm. So when we are doing the work around white supremacy and white body supremacy, it's very important to understand that white people don't have a collective understanding of that. And that's part of their work, part of their healing work, is to work on those pieces of brutalization at the hands of other white people. Part of that is to work on that, not to work on us or understand race, or try and teach us about race, right? Mm. Especially if you don't have any collective agility or efficacy with it, that has to be cultivated. And white folks have not cultivated that, right? Mm-hmm. What they've done is made declarations. I'm not a racist.
Yep.
Right. And they make individual declarations and want you to be deferential to that, right? Mm. To their individual declarations. But when you say, do you have a people that you've cultivated a living embodied anti-racist practices and culture with? Have you developed a culture that will that you will raise babies in, that you will name in, that you will create educational? Have you done that? Then shut up, right? And so the reason why I say white body supremacy is that the white body deems itself the supreme standard by which all bodies humanity shall be measured. Yes. Structurally and philosophically. If you don't understand that one piece, all of this stuff will confuse you. Mm. Everything will confuse you because you will think that white supremacy is about the KKK or the American Nazi Party or Nazis or Proud Boys or whatever it is over to England, because I know they got, you know, stuff. Oh,
Britain's First, whatever the latest is. Yeah, yeah.
You see, it's all because here's what people don't understand, is that when we talk about white body supremacy, and that what I mean by that is that the white body has deemed itself the standard of humanness. The race question is a species question.
Mm.
It is a species question. Always has been a species question. And that idea of speciesness is interwoven in and around and through the Western thought and the white intellectual foundations, right? So Britain, France, Belgium, Portugal, and Spain shared a knowledge helix.
Yes.
So you'd have somebody in Spain that would talk about who Black people were and who African people were and who Indigenous people were and create these pseudo-intellectual things. And then people in Portugal would read that and say, oh, yeah, we have the same experience. Their brains are smaller. Mm-hmm. Blah, 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 right? And then that person would read something and come up with a theory, and then somebody in Britain would read it. Yeah. Right. And then somebody in France would read it. That's how white body supremacy became supreme, is that there was a knowledge helix that allowed them to share things through their intellectual endeavors around who Black people were and who Indigenous people were, through their warring, through their institutions, or through their religion, through all of those pieces, right? Mm. And so what ends up happening is that when we just say white supremacy, we can think of it as a thing that bad people do.
Yes.
And what I want to say is, if that is where you land, then you will miss the fact that this whole thing is constructed on a white body being shorthand for human.
Yes.
And that notion has been woven in around and through every institution that the superpowers of their time shared.
Mm-hmm.
They shared notions of who African people were, of who Indian people were, of who Asian people were. And those people were seen, and those bodies were seen as savage or deviant to white bodies. The proximal power, you gain power by your approximation to the white body.
Yeah.
Right? And so that's what I mean by white body supremacy, is that the white body deems itself the supreme standard by which all bodies humanity shall be measured structurally and philosophically. If you miss that, everything else will confuse you.
Yeah, and it does. We see it play out over and over again.
And they weave it through the school system. They weave it through DEI training and implicit bias training. Right. Right. That's why, let me tell you, that's why these types of notions make billions of dollars for people. Is because it never questions the foundational rubrics.
Yeah.
It's only transactional things. Well, somebody is racist because they did that to Black people or did that to Asian people. But we don't study, and this is why I go to the body, we don't study how these just the notion. Let's say that the one thing that we're going to look at and work with and interrogate is the idea that the white body has deemed itself the supreme standard of humanness. Let's say just that piece. If you don't stay there and cultivate and work with that, you will very easily, in a cognitive way, move off of that. And I'm talking about white bodies now, and then divorce yourselves from that notion.
Yes.
And what I've been trying to say is that white folks have got to build a container that will not allow themselves to divorce themselves from that rubric,
yes,
from that piece, and let it cook and let it simmer to see what emerges from that. And so that's why I talk about white body supremacy and not just white supremacy.
This might not be the intention with it, but for me, it does this thing where it invites people in white bodies to take responsibility and pay attention to what's going on. But also, I feel that it also provides a separation in terms of, okay, this isn't about me as an individual. This is about a collective, which I think is actually more useful to think. So it's both. You can't move away, but also it gives space.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
Exactly right. Now, so one of the most difficult things that I've realized in the work that I'm doing is getting white people to stay in a room with other white people.
Ooh.
Especially if you're talking about race. They could stay in a room and talk about crumpets and
dogs.
They could stay in a room and talk about sourdough bread or eating Mexican food. They could stay in a room and talk about that shit all day. But because they have no agility or no efficacy around race, when it shows up, it has so much charge to it that there are only a few things that they can do.
Mm.
They can either get angry.
Yep.
They could either cry and collapse,
mm-hmm,
or they can grab the hand of another white person and say, we're going to stay here for the next generation, and we are going to work on our own shit. We're going to work on the brutality that never got healed at the hands of other white folks.
Yeah.
That brutality that was instilled in you and now looks like culture.
Yeah.
The idea of individual only and pulling yourself up by your bootstraps only is a violent idea.
Yeah.
It is a violent idea to think that it is only you without the balance of the community. This is why some white adjacent black some white adjacent black and bodies of culture and white people. This is why you see white people not wanting to wear masks, right? One of the reasons why you see them not wanting to wear a mask, and they genuflect, at least here, genuflect to it is their right not to wear a mask, is because they don't have any efficacy when it comes to communal stuff around race. There is none. It has always been around the individual, and the individual supersedes the communal. Right? Not in balance with the communal, supersedes it. And so this is why you see people burning their masks. This is why you see people all right with 500,000 Americans dying.
Wow.
Right? This is why, because this stuff around the individual white body is God in and of itself. And when I mean God, I mean the arbiter in that one moment in time. And the white body here has been conditioned to be that. The moment that in Virginia law that they started using the term white persons, not landowners, not merchants, persons. The moment that that happened, the white body became the supreme standard. It became the standard of humanness. So you could be working in the fields right next to an enslaved African. And because the structure is organized around you, like I can tell if you're human based on your pigmentation as shorthand.
Yeah.
Right. At that moment, the white body became the supreme standard.
Yeah.
And white folks have no interest and have not created a culture that can unwind that. And that's what they have to do. They have to unwind all of that.
And let's be honest. You know, I mean, I know what the incentive is because I'm looking at things bigger than my own experience. But for most who are still in that individualistic way of thinking, what's in it for me?
That's right. That's right. That's right. So say that last piece. Say that last piece again. That the individual.
So people that are still into a mindset of individualistic thinking. Why should I bother? What's in it for me?
So what's in it for you is that your children, if you don't begin to put the seeds together and commit to a living embodied anti-racist culture and practice and ushering that through, your children will continue to suicide themselves. Your children will continue to think that it's all right to grow up and grope women by the genitals. Your children will continue to think that rape is something that is a problem for women. Your children will die earlier. You will actually be sowing the seeds of destruction in your country. So what's in it for you is to actually reclaim your humanity, rehumanize yourself, right? Because what you have participated in and what your ancestors participated in is literally destroying you. You can look at January 6th here. It is literally destroying America. The quaking that we refuse to look at and address is literally destroying America. It is, and so what's in it for you is, and there may not be anything in it for you if what you mean by that is that there is a reciprocal, immediate reciprocal thing. If that is transactional, if that's what you mean when you say what's in it for me is that I give something and I get something.
Yeah.
That's not what this is. This is you give something and you don't get shit. You give something and you will lose something. You give something and more will be required of you to give more. Because the thing that you have has been done on the backs of indigenous people in New Zealand, in Australia, in China, in Africa, in America, in the colonies. People have died for you to have what you have. People have been murdered for you to have what you have. My ancestors were legally raped for you to have what you have. My indigenous brothers and sisters here, their ancestors died because you wanted to take the land. So what you have, what's in it for you is your humanity. You have to decide if that's enough.
Powerful. And there's something you just shared I want to pick up on, particularly with how the relationship with Black people and white people, black bodies and white bodies, has always been transactional. So actually this is doing the opposite of that. This work is consciously doing the opposite of that.
Exactly right. This is not transactional.
Yeah.
I'm quick to say, when I'm doing my training, I'm quick to say this. I ain't for everybody. You may get to a point of doing this work with me and it's too much for you. You need to take a break. You need to get a therapist because stuff is starting to pop up for you that you need somebody to help you work. You need a healer. You need somebody to help you work through that. I don't know what people's timelines are. What I do know is that people think that they want to do anti-racist work. But adding a somatic element to it takes it to a whole nother level.
Yeah.
And people think they're prepared for it. People will tell me all the time, Resma, I'm a somatic practitioner. I know exactly what you're doing. I see what you're doing and all that different type of stuff. And, you know, your intellect is not going to save you in this.
Yeah.
Right. It is. Are you going to link with other people? Are you going to go through this as opposed to taking the normal dodges around it? Right. And so what you come to the table with will push you. This process will push you up against your edges, your suffering's edges. Mm. And at those points, you get to decide.
Yeah.
Is this what I'm going to do? Or am I going to go back and eat kale or you know, whatever it is that soothes me down? And white people always have that at their disposal.
That's the privilege that they have. They can tap out at any time, and we cannot.
That's right. That's even more so than privilege. I call it advantage now.
Well, yeah.
Advantage to be born in a white body, in a society, and in a structure that's predicated on the white body being shorthand for humanness. And white folks have not created a container to hold that. And that's what you saw when you saw Pierce Morgan roll his big ass off of the television screen, right? Yeah. He could not hold it. That speaks to the level of thinness in the container for white people.
It's just non-existent because, you know, again, all Alex was respectful, reasonable, measured, human, and he was holding a boundary and saying, like, none of this is okay.
That's exactly right.
And he walked off set and then no longer works for Good Morning Britain. So it's just this immaturity, this huge emotional immaturity.
You just hit it. You just hit it, sis. Immaturity is built into the system and structure of white body supremacy, right? Yeah. Through white folks' participation in white body supremacy, they have infantilized themselves.
Mm. Right?
So when they get up against something that has to do with race, it's very difficult for them to hold it and either not collapse and cry, strike out, make people pay for it, make people attend to their needs, lend them to white solidarity, lend into pseudo-white fragility, lend into those pieces because they have not developed a cultural container specifically around race that will give them other ways of moving through it.
Yeah, 100%. I talk a lot to my students about child, I reframe it in terms of child ego. It's this childish, belligerent state that needs to be met and automatically soothed and like a baby would. And this, we've said it before, this lack of agility or this immaturity. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say. It's like, okay, so in any other circumstance other than racism, what would you do to help you? But it's missing. It's the missing component. And it's what I find it just extraordinary to witness.
Well, one of the reasons why I like when we get together and Black folks get together and talk is that one of the things that I'm very clear about is that, so the work that I do, right, I get paid. I get paid. And the reason why I get paid is because this shit is brutal.
Yeah.
This, and any Black person that's doing this type of work, you need to get paid, and you need to get paid well. Because the many times white people, like what you saw with Sharon Osbourne, was her saying, teach me, show me, like as if yes. it was that Black woman's job to do that. Right. And that's the deference piece that white body that has been conditioned in the white body, is that white bodies expect our deference. They expect us to give up literal parts of ourselves in order to attend to their needs, because that's the way they've been conditioned. Right. Yeah. That's the way it's been. And so one of the things that I'm really clear about in telling Black people and other bodies of culture is that when somebody says, well, show me this or teach me this or can you, and if I just understood, at that moment, you have to pause and you have to decide whether or not you want to use your life energy in that way, because there is a cost.
Yeah.
There is a literal cost to doing this. And it ain't your job.
Mm.
It is not your job to do it. It is my job because I have leaned into this. This is something, right? It is your job because that's what you do. You have decided that's what you're going to do. It is Rachel Cargill's job. It is sister, you know, Sonya Renee Taylor's, is, you know what I mean? Sister Adrienne Marie. It's our jobs to do these pieces. But it ain't just individual. I ain't working on no assembly line and have Joe ask me about racism. It ain't my job to teach you, Joe. No. Right. So, yeah, that's deep, man.
Oh, boy. OK, one more question. I'm mindful of time. and it's a big one. But what can, you know, to our people who are listening to this, like what can, you know, this isn't something that's going away anytime soon. So what should we be prioritizing right now? How can we center our healing and to navigate?
Yeah, I think this just actually came to me this morning. I think we have to, as Black people, specifically, and as bodies of culture generally, I think we have to up our hug quotient.
Mm-hmm.
We got to start hugging people more, each other more. We have to start being softer with each other. Mm-hmm. We have to start rocking with each other, humming with each other, grunting with each other, giving each other permission to grieve, giving each other permission to wail. this grief is not just individual. It is not just grief I'm grieving for Brianna or for Brother Floyd. It is the grief of my ancestor. And that's why it sounds so awesome. And I don't mean awesome like in a good way. I mean like when I'm hearing myself wail, it doesn't sound humanly.
Yes.
It sounds like it's coming from someplace else. And that's because Our people are continue to be brutalized. So we never have had any reprieve to actually grieve what happens and has continued to happen to us. So my thing is we have to continue to create and reclaim those pieces that will allow us to be buttressed, have some reprieve, and lean into the natural pieces, both individually and communally. And not do it with the white gaze. When I say gaze, I mean G-A-Z-E, right? White people love gazing at our
trauma,
our healing, our this, our that. We have to understand that in the blackness, in doing stuff in the blackness, when you do that, people other than the people that are there, nobody else should be gazing at that. That is sacred. That is important. When my grandmother is rocking and she's humming, and I got my ear on her chest and my vagal nerve is vibrating with her vagal nerve as she's humming, that's sacred. We have to reclaim that stuff. When I reach over and my 20-year-old son is in the car and I reach over and just lace my fingers with his fingers and he doesn't pull away, that's sacred. Nobody should be gazing at that. When the protests happen and you're having black bodies sitting on the corner, rocking back and forth, back to back, humming with each other.
Wow.
White people, news organizations should not be allowed to film that. Because that's sacred. Right? When 3 months after the uprisings and people are getting together and they're rocking and they're crying and they're wailing and they know somebody's going to be there with them without and not giving them advice, right? That's healing. That's creating wailing houses, because we know it's not just the wail of Brother George Floyd or Sister Breonna. It's the wail of our ancestors. So we need to create room and opportunities for that to occur. That's what I think. And it can't be through white people giving us any permission or anybody else giving us permission. We have to create these things. Black women all over this world are creating things. I really believe this next decade is the decade of the black woman.
Really?
I really believe it is. I believe that black women are seeing, are knitting together what I was saying earlier, the right ordering.
Ooh.
You're doing things without permission.
Yeah.
They're doing things. The fact that we have Democratic House, Senate, and presidency is a testimony to black women. Don't get it twisted.
It's
a testimony, right? It's a testimony to indigenous women. Don't get it twisted. It's a testimony to Asian women, but primarily it's a testimony to black women. Not asking for permission, doing, claiming, reclaiming, and taking particular care, not self-care, because that's got a whole thing to it now, but taking particular care on understanding their relationship to creation itself.
Wow. I hear you. And I think what a powerful way to end. Rezma, I could talk to you for hours. Thank you so much for who you are and the work that you do. And where can people find you if they want to find out more about your work?
At Rezma Menakem, R-E-S-M-A-A-M-E-N-A-K-E-M. I'm on Instagram. That's the best way you can reach. You can also contact me on Facebook, but Instagram is where I put all my videos and all that stuff up, as well as they can take a free class at resma.com, R-E-S-M-A-A.com. And if they go to Linktree, linktr.ee/resma, all of the stuff that I do is up there. So. Please come on in, and this can't be the last time we do this, sis.
No, it won't be. It won't be. And also, grab a copy of Rezma's My Grandmother's Hands as well. Thank you so much.
All right, sis. Talk to you soon.
Bye. And there you have it. Rezma Menakem, my friends. And when Rezma shared that black women are putting together the right ordering, profound. It ties into some of what my other guest, Daniel Edmund, who I don't believe has met Rezma Menakem at all, was saying in our BLM 1 year on special, season 2, episode 3. If you haven't listened, I invite you to go back and listen to that too. But there is something quite profound in both of these men sharing those words. There is a phrase that Resma shared that is reverberating through my body, and to the people who ask, well, why should we do anti-racism work? I live in a majority white town, or I teach in a majority white school. What's in it for me? What's in it for you is your humanity, and you have to decide if it's enough. Powerful. You can find more about Resma. Please follow him on his social handles, and remember, there is a free course for people who want to heal from racialized trauma that you can find on his website, resmamenakem.com. All of these wonderful resources will be linked in the show notes. Collectively and individually, we have got a lot of work to do, and it starts with healing and looking at the parts of ourselves that scare us, frighten us, disgust us. And you have to decide if that is what you're ready to undertake. Because that is a measure of the work that we are doing. And we will only make change in the world if we have the courage to reclaim our humanity. So, you know what to do. If this episode has resonated with you, please hop on over to your podcast host and leave us a review. Until next time, take care of yourself and your body. See you soon.